I'm Afshin Ratansi and welcome to Going Underground. We're back and coming to you for now from a new location today, exactly 40 years since several thousand Argentine troops seized the Falkland Islands or Malvinas back from Great Britain before Margaret Thatcher's British Army took it back 74 days later. This is the annual EU-China summit is scheduled for its second day after Friday's peace talks between Ukraine and Russia. All this while the EU has banned this program and this TV channel, still broadcast all around the world except in NATO-aligned countries. Well, joining me now from Rome for this episode is former advisor to the European Union's High Representative for Common Foreign and Security Policy and Conflicts Forum founder, Alistair Crook. Alistair, welcome back on Going Underground. Let's begin with perhaps the need for you to remind us what you think is the start of this conflict and the reasons for the conflict, given that certainly in the European Union, where dissent is arguably banned, we are told almost hourly that Putin invaded Ukraine without provocation.
No, it's very clear that what we're dealing with is really something, and it's much broader than just the Ukraine. And both Presidents Putin and Xi have both said that this is about reordering, if you like, the security architecture of the globe, the global security architecture, away from a simple, a rules-based order that is set by the United States in order to give these other states a seat at the board, if you like, to be able to have a discussion. There is really no communication for that. There was a very good analogy made by someone that it was like a chessboard, and the United States sit at one end of the chessboard, and someone said, well, do two play this game of chess? And it was Brzezinski, in fact. And Brzezinski said, no, it's for one. There's no other at this game. We just simply turn the board around, and then we play from the other side. And that's been going on, really, for a long time, 19th century. And now Russia and China want a seat at that chessboard. And they don't accept any longer that the United States simply turns the chessboard through 180 degrees and starts playing from the other side as well as their own side. So they want a seat at the chessboard. That's what Ukraine is about. Was there a provocation? Yes, because people have been warning from, long time, 2007, even the present head of the CIA in Washington, when he was ambassador in Moscow, said, if you move NATO into Georgia and Ukraine, there will be war. It's inevitable.
Difficult, though, for China, the EU-China virtual summit, day two on the Saturday. I'm not sure whether the EU will be again lecturing China about human rights. But despite the reaffirmation of the alliance, more than alliance, between Beijing and Moscow, of course, Poland, Ukraine, Italy, where you are, they are Belt and Road countries. Ukraine, one of the biggest investments in Europe coming from China. How does China navigate that? How is it allied to Russia, even whilst these countries that are spearheading the conflict, certainly in information terms, they're on Washington's side?
There is a very close rapport between Russia and China. And I think the decision, if you like, to disassociate from Europe and from the West generally, was probably taken even a year before the famous declaration that was made by both the Chinese and the Russian presidents in Beijing, where they said they will no longer put up with, if you like, an American imposed global order, that we are going to change that and going to contest the global order. And of course, that has caused a great deal of anger and also anxiety in the West about this prospect. But I think it's very clear where it's going because they do coordinate very closely. And we've seen Russia's response. Russia's response is it has a list of friendly nations with whom it does business and transacts diplomatically with them, and those that are not and are really excluded, probably won't even be able to get visas to travel. I think China will do it in its own time, but this is the model that we're going to see In other words, two spheres, two separate spheres. And remaining on the fence is going to be so uncomfortable and so painful that it will become impossible eventually. So people will have to choose which side they want to reside on. We saw a bit of that with the, although it was more complicated than that, but with Moscow telling the Europeans, you know, you want oil, you want gas, okay, pay in one, no more dollars, no more euros after you stole our foreign reserve accounts in the United States and in Europe.
Yeah, some people actually commented that leaving $300 billion in foreign assets in dollars may well have been a Moscow trick. It seemed all too easy, so that immediately Russia could retaliate by saying it must be charged in rubles when it comes to energy resources in Europe. What do you think, say Berlin, where energy resources are all important from Russia? I mean, will the lights go out? They are talking about the need perhaps for rationing, but then the G7 says, absolutely not. You're breaking a contract and you must charge, if not in dollars, then in euros. And I should just also say, we're not regulated by the British regulator anymore, but as you know, NATO-aligned countries all say this is unprovoked from Moscow.
Well, first of all, I mean, that's you've raised a number of points in this issue, but it was provoked essentially by the taking of, if you like, instruments, debt instruments that are called foreign reserves. And those debt instruments, I mean, if you like, when you simply seize them or cancel them, as the United States and Europe has done, I mean, that's a breach of contract too. That is a clear breach of the contract to pay on those contracts, like US treasuries or on currencies. They are just, if you like, an obligation to pay those who cancel. So if you like, in a sense, Russia can always plead force majeure. Now, as to changing the contract, I've heard a lot of that from European countries saying, oh, well, you know, we can't change the contract, it's unchangeable. But Europe proposed precisely that to Russia not so long ago, because they said they didn't want any longer to have long-term contracts with Russia. They'd like to have spot prices for their gas. And we're moving in that direction, and we'd like to go onto the spot market for the prices. So let's change our contract that way. So if it was all right for the EU to propose that, why is it not all right for Russia to propose that they now pay in one? It shouldn't be too difficult for them to pay in one, but we all know there's an underlying reason why they don't want to do that, because there's a fear that the financial system, which is already shifting, the global monetary system, is already shifting away from fiat money, which basically has no real backing to it at all. It's just a promise to pay, nothing more, and a promise to pay by printing more money. But moving away from that to a commodities and an asset-based currencies, i.e. currencies that are based on real things, like either gas, oil, wheat, whatever, rare metals, or gold. And this is where we seem to be moving. I mean, it was in 1971 that Nixon did away with the gold window. And now, quietly, without much attention in the press, Russia has reestablished a gold window for rubles. And that translates also into an equivalent price of rubles for the dollar of about 75 rubles for the dollar. Since they did this, we've seen the ruble shoot up in value against the dollar. And then they've also said, we'd like to have, you know, payment in rubles, which means that these foreign companies in the European Union are going to have to go and buy rubles. And that is going to push the ruble up further and make it a much more valuable currency as a trading instrument too. So, you know, paradoxically, you remember it was only in the beginning of March that the French finance minister was saying, our aim is to collapse the Russian economy and to collapse, obviously, the ruble as part of that. He said that at the beginning of March. And now, 1 month later, we see in the financial press many commentators talking about this is beginning of the end of the fiat global monetary system, because there's a crisis of confidence in that. Ultimately, you know, it worked so long as the dollar was vaguely in line with certain commodities. But since they made the mistake of sanctioning Russia so heavily, Russia is the kingpin of all commodities. Food, resources, oil, gas, precious metals, everything comes from Russia. They don't have supply lines. So when they do that, they've made a mayhem in all of the commodity markets. And that's affecting the fiat currency.
When it comes to the way the rest of the world sees this conflict, I'm not sure what you thought about the Western reports, NATO nation reports that Saudi Arabia, the UAE refused Biden's phone call. We know that suddenly a team was sent to Venezuela, where one think tank said 40,000 were killed by US sanctions against the Maduro government there. The World Food Program is warning about wheat prices in Egypt, the biggest wheat buyer. Does China and Russia together have the kind of infrastructural clout to be able to save the world from global famine caused, if you believe Moscow, by NATO expansion eastward, and if you believe NATO, caused by Vladimir Putin?
It is not so straightforward, because we have a major problem with food rising, which is not just concerned with the war in Ukraine, although Ukraine and Russia combined produce something like 35% of global wheat supplies. So yes, to that extent, but it is also something that is more than that, because there are other factors involved in it. First of all, we have a drought in much of the Middle East, which is affecting production, food production across the Middle East. So that's an important factor. But also because some of the sanctions on Russia have affected important areas of fertilizers, other things that are necessary in food production. Certain gas is necessary also. And all of these are being blocked at the moment by sanctions. And so it's causing a huge problem. And in some cases, farmers in the West are not planting crops or not planning to plant crops because the price of fertilizers has shot up. The components to these either come from Belarus or they come from Russia, and they're just not available at the moment. So one part of it is sanctions. One part of it is the conflict that's taking place in Ukraine. Another part of it is drought. And another part is the fact that in many parts of the world, the attempt to move towards a greener world from the sort of, if you like, the Davos agenda has actually meant that crops are not being planted there. So it's got several components to it, I think, this problem. And it's certainly we are going to feel the effects on prices, inflation. Food is going to be very expensive. Inflation in Europe is soaring, as it is in the United States and many other places. This is becoming a major crisis. The sanctions, in many ways, Europe has not sanctioned Russia, it's sanctioning itself. You know, not being able to get things like fertilizers, not being able to get things that are necessary, food that is necessary, is sanctioning Europeans, going to make it much harder for people to survive on incomes because the prices are going up so rapidly.
Alistair Crook, I'll stop you there. More from the former advisor to the European Union's High Representative for Common Foreign and Security Policy after this break. Welcome back. I'm still here with former British diplomat and founder of Conflicts Forum, Alistair Crook. Do you think that the European Union just doesn't understand? You were an advisor to the equivalent of the EU foreign minister, because at the same time as the rest of the world maybe holds fast, certainly Bolsonaro in Brazil, in South Africa, all these countries in the global south de facto back Russia, as seen by NATO. Meanwhile, in Europe, the war by Russia is paid for by European Union money, de facto. 100 billion, Fortune magazine said, comes from the European Union into Russia to pay for gas, oil, and coal. At the same time, as you just said, they are in effect sanctioning themselves, and Berlin is telling its citizens to perhaps ration gas, and all over Western Europe they're talking about, well, some of them talking about mass fuel poverty.
I think you raise a really important question, because I don't see any sign that the Europeans gave any thought to the strategic consequences of what they were doing. They were so caught up in the sort of sense of the struggle against Russia, against Putin, the dictator, and all of this. And it's become a sort of fervor in Europe. Or everywhere, there are sort of blue and yellow symbols of Ukraine. It's become such a fervor that I don't think they really thought. I mean, Europe cannot manage as it is. They cannot get gas from anywhere else that will substitute from Russian gas. That's just obvious. The Americans have promised a small amount of new liquefied gas, natural gas, but that will cover about 4% of EU needs. Europe required 40%. Qatar is not going to be able to supply it. It's not going to get supplied. So why do they go into these things without any thinking? And then suddenly they say, well, we're going to divest ourselves from reliance on Russian or oil and gas within a year. How? I mean, have they got a plan for this? Is this serious? How are you going to do that? You know, you can't just change these things overnight. Then they're surprised when Russia says, okay, now pay in rubles. Did they not consider that possibility? Did they not think where it was going to take them? Have they not considered the impact on inflation? And inflation is soaring in the European Union at the moment, while they still stay on a monetary and economic policy, which is nuts. They're still doing quantitative easing and negative interest rates, effectively, and buying all the bonds that certain countries produce to fund their debt. I mean, how long can you go on that sort of basis when inflation is, you know, the inflation figures are highly manipulated, but we're talking about large figures, double-digit figures in Europe in reality, even if they say it's a little less. And people are going to feel a huge amount of pain. The costs of gas and electricity, like in the UK, are going to go up 50%. They've gone up 50%. They'll probably go up another 100% before the end of this year. How are people going to survive with this? Have they not made any consideration? Have they not thought it through? They've cut off all the links. They've created a sort of uncurtain against Russia. They can't even talk to Russia or to Putin at the moment. They've so cut themselves off in their sort of enthusiasm and their excitement for projecting European values into what they see as a sort of barbarian culture of Russia. It's not that, of course, but that's how they seem to see it. And so, you know, that's why I'm very pessimistic that they can come up with a real solution.
Well, of course, Joe Biden assures Europe that the fracked gas from the US will be on time. And important commentators and think tanks in NATO countries constantly talk about Qatar saving the day.
Both of those are rubbish. The actual contract that the Americans, that the European Union produced, doesn't have any commitment to that extra 15 billion cubic meters of gas. It says America will do its best endeavors to meet it. Best endeavors is, you know, full of holes. Qatar has said formally, I know a German minister went there and came back and said Qatar has said that they will help out with gas. But actually Doha has said formally, we never made that commitment. We couldn't make the commitment. We don't have the capacity to make that commitment. I'm very sorry if we cannot replace Russian gas. So where, EU, is it coming from?
Well, as you know, and as you alluded to, for instance, UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson talking about it's the principle that matters. This is about the foundations of the European ideal philosophically. Even the Enlightenment being talked about, obviously, one feels it strangely when it comes to the banning of free expression and free media. Obviously, RT comes to mind, but of course, CGTN and Press TV media is banned, dissenting media. Zelensky has been the subject, arguably, of a huge PR operation in Western Europe and NATO-aligned countries. What do you think he faces at home in Ukraine as per the far-right elements in Ukraine society? And is, in effect, Putin need to protect him as peace talks go forward if a peace deal is to emerge?
I mean, it's a complicated picture, but we do know that Zelensky, of course, has, I mean, all of these Zoom meetings with parliaments and have been carefully choreographed, and someone has provided the videos and the means to do this, and that almost certainly is the United States. And the question really comes down to the issue of, is the United States ready? Are all of European states, because some of them don't seem to be, really ready for a long war? Or do they want a short war in the Ukraine and a political settlement? And it's not clear that that decision has yet been made. We see that. I think you mentioned yourself at the start that there was, you know, so far there was nothing and there would be another meeting later on. I don't think Zelensky is a free agent in this. He is very close, you know, even with his background, he is surrounded by members of the Azov and right sector groups. And works very closely with some of the leaders of those groups. And are they ready for a ceasefire or an ending of the process? It's not clear that that is the case, but it's also not clear. I mean, Russia has set certain objectives for this military operation, and it is still possible that if they feel they've achieved those objectives, they may feel that the best thing is simply just to go and leave. And the Donetsk and Luhansk republics will be look after themselves in their own way once the Russians have completed their military operation. The Black Sea coast will be similarly probably an autonomous region. Maybe Western Ukraine will be taken by the Poles. Maybe parts of the other parts of Ukraine will be taken by Hungary. We don't know quite. Certainly the Polish Prime Minister has made it very clear they have territorial ambitions, because most of that land on the west, Lviv and all of that, were Polish originally. And he said they have territorial needs, requirements from Ukraine. And I think there was a long conversation between the Polish president and that of Biden when he was in Warsaw. When the Polish president was arguing very strongly that the Polish military should be able to go into Ukraine and take some of that land that was theirs originally. So, I mean, we may see something very different as the outcome. If there can't be a negotiated diplomatic outcome, we may find it's a sort of de facto Balkanization that takes place in Ukraine. I'm not sure who that would suit, if anyone. But I mean, one can't say that is not going to be an option. It might be the only thing that emerges, faute de mieux, for lack of anything better to arrive from the situation.
Presumably China wouldn't appreciate that too much with its close trading ties with Kiev. But if billions of dollars worth of weapons continues to be poured into Ukraine by NATO-aligned countries, notably the United States, that many see as prolonging the war, can we see an uptick in the violence? We've seen the pictures of so many refugees, let alone dead bodies of civilians. Can we see an uptick in increased violence, or will NATO, along with businesses and the corporations of the planet, eventually have to back down to save the planet, in effect?
Well, you know, the United States continues to pour money in. They've just announced more money, another tranche and more weapons to go there. I'm not sure that they can actually get those weapons into Ukraine because the Russians have been very adept at destroying weapons supplies and weapons dumps inside Ukraine, even close to the Polish border. So it's not so clear that this is really possible. But nonetheless, can the war go on? I think there is a camp within, let's call it a camp within Washington, that would like it to become a quagmire, like Afghanistan was for the Soviet Union all those years ago when I was there. Would they like to do the same? One camp does. That's largely the State Department position. I think another one like the Pentagon is much less enthusiastic about that, much less enthusiastic because it fears that this might lead to a bigger conflict with Russia.
Alistair Crook, thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for the show. If you're watching this on Saturday, it'll be replayed on Monday. Keep in touch via all our social media if it's available in your country. And remember, you can continue to watch Going Underground episodes globally on TV outside NATO-aligned countries and always on Odyssey and RT.com.